Again, I'd first like to ensure that everyone has silenced their cell phones. And then I would please ask of you to help me join Tom W. from Oakland.
I'm Tom, I'm an alcoholic. Glad to be here tonight. Lee contacted me a while ago, and I've known Lee a long time. And glad to hang out with sober people. I get to do that a lot. I was just thinking as I was sitting there, this is a clappy group, so I know we're close to Los Angeles. Where I get, we don't clap for anybody. We just stare at them. We're not a very active group. But hello from Oakland, California, and I've had the opportunity to go to meetings in many different places in the world. I'd like to mention just a couple of them. Just to know, when you travel anywhere, there's always a meeting. And you can find it very quickly, and people take you there, and it's extraordinary. I was at a meeting in San Francisco years ago, and there was an old-timer named Frank B. And he was a longshoreman, he was a union activist. He was very much involved in the general strike of 1938, way back in the labor days, you know. And he was supposed to chair the meeting, and what he said was, "My name's Frank, I'm an alcoholic. I drank till I killed a man. Does anyone have a topic?" And that was, so, hi, Frank. And he was wonderful. He was just pure gold, and he spent a lot of time with people on the margins, and everybody knew Frank B. And I was privileged to hang out with him a little tiny bit. And I was in Johannesburg, South Africa. I got to go there a few years ago before COVID to give some talks on recovery connected by church people. So I was talking with rooms full of Anglicans and Catholics and Lutherans in South Africa, bishops and nuns and pastors. There was a cardinal there, and he laughed at my joke, so I knew he was smart. When they don't laugh, I just figure, well, use smaller words. So I was there. Anyway, at the end of Saturday, a group of fellas came up to me and they said, "Would you like to get to a meeting tonight?" I said, "I'd love to get to a meeting." And all these guys were Indians. There's a huge Indian community in South Africa. So we were in Durban, and the meeting was in a Catholic church, and about 100 people, 150 people, mostly men, some women, newcomers just like tonight, and brand new people, and someone was getting a birthday cake. And what I noticed in the room was full of Christians, Muslims, and Hindus, and we're all staying sober together. And for the prayer at the end, they don't join hands, they do this, they stand like good Indians, and prayed. And I just said, "Oh, I'm so glad I saw this. This helps me realize that we can get along with a little more effort." I'm a sober person, and I didn't plan on being a sober person. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my stuff. And if I say anything that's helpful, please use it. And if it's not helpful, don't worry about it. If I say something and you disagree with me, that's really okay too. I don't have to leave. You don't have to leave. And you don't have to tell me about it. You can just call your sponsor and work it out. Let me go home. I've been traveling for the last few days, and I'm very jet laggy. So if this is a bad talk, I'm blaming it on the airlines. Grew up in San Jose, and we had orchards still. And my dad was the superintendent of the cannery, so he knew every farmer in the Santa Clara Valley. And at that time, the Santa Clara Valley was mostly farms. And some drinking in the house. Some drinking on both sides of the family. I'm the youngest of three, and I was a sneaky kid around alcohol. I would sneak sips out of bottles and drink beer and stuff like that. I remember one of the things they would do in with the Catholic community right around Bar Mitzvah time, you had the opportunity to take the pledge, which means I will not drink till I'm 21. My sponsor did it and he kept it. Lots of people take it and don't keep it. I didn't want to take it. We had to go in and see the pastor, and he's a very gruff old man. And he said, you want to take the pledge? And I don't know if you sign something or, you know, prick your finger, and I don't know what you do with. But I said, no, I'm not interested in the pledge. I think I was 12 years old. He said, why not? And I said, I enjoy champagne. Because I'd been to some weddings, and it is just delicious. And he said to me, you have expensive tastes. And I was dismissed. I drank in high school, and it was party time. We'd go from San Jose to Santa Cruz over Highway 17, Blood Alley. And I'm a drunk driver. I think I did not have to drink to drive badly, but I did drink and drive. And there was an old-time speaker named Norm Alpe. There are recordings of him out there. He talks a little too fast, and you have to listen more than once to get all the words. But he would talk about his life being a matter of seconds and inches. He'd say a couple of seconds different, a couple of inches different, and it would be a very different story. And that's really true for me. I have been stopped by police officers while crossing the Golden Gate, not the Golden, the Oakland Bay Bridge. I'd had a couple of beers and a joint, so I was a very good driver. And he pulled me over, and we had a brief conversation. He said, where are you getting? I said, Berkeley, which is just 10 minutes away. He said, get home. But he should have arrested me. And I never had a driving accident. But in the paper, whenever there's an article about a car full of kids crashing against a tree at 3 in the morning, I read that article very carefully. That could have been me a dozen times. My oldest brother ran away from home and joined the army. And my middle brother was very introverted, so you never noticed he was there. And I, at the 18, I joined the Jesuit order. I ran away and joined the circus. And it's an international community. I've been a member for 60 years, which means I should be a better person by now. But an awful lot of my active adult alcoholism all happened within the context of the order. Just a lot of study, a lot of this, a lot of that, and booze was always readily available. I was in Spokane, Washington for 2 very long, excruciating years. And every Friday, they'd bring into the common room. It's a commune. It's an ashram. They'd bring into the common room a 15-gallon kegger of beer. And my life was possible because a lot of people didn't drink. But I just knowing that was available, getting a glass of beer and going back to my room to do whatever you do philosophically, that happened a lot. I thought I'd be a high school teacher my whole life. And I taught school in Los Angeles, and I was I taught history, things I was, I'm not a professional historian, but I'm an amateur, and I get fascinated by stuff, and then I read a lot. And so I taught European history, and I taught Russian history, and modern German history, and I got all these kids involved in stuff, and I remember for the French Revolution, I taught them the words to the Marseillaise, and we marched on the principal's office. I told him it was the Bastille, and we're going to kill him. Now that's imprudent, and people start getting nervous. So I didn't always make good choices, but I was interesting. I loved L.A. It was a great place to be in my early 20s. Lots going on, and I drove drunk a lot in Los Angeles and I defended my right to drive drunk. I thought I was a better driver drunk than a lot of people were sober, and I had a lot of denial and stupidity on my daily basis. I never drank in the morning. I didn't know you could. But I have shown up for class terribly hungover and very unprepared. And for a while in my recovery, I would have said my drinking did not affect my teaching at all, but that's a lie. It did. It did affect my teaching. And there was some very bad behavior. Went to school in Berkeley for theology, and from being an extremely busy high school person, and if you know any high school teachers, it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I taught 5 classes a day, 5 days a week, and then outside, you're very involved with kids all the time. But graduate school, there's nothing to do. So my drinking changed. And instead of drinking on the run, being very busy and drinking, I would just go to my room and drink. Got more and more isolated. I had some bad experiences. And I'm a little frightened by my drinking. I remember my last year or so of drinking, I went into therapy to ask the doctor why I drank like I drank. Not my first therapist. But this is the first time with that as the issue. Because there were times I could drink and nothing bad would happen, and then there were times I would drink and bad stuff happened. The driving being part of it, but a lot of other stupid, selfish things that got in the way that I thought at the time were hilarious. I find sometimes others don't share my sense of humor. My friend Patricia, who suicided in 1994 on a relapse, she was great company. But she's a New Yorker. She said every so often all of her friends would lose their sense of humor and she'd have to leave town. I've had that experience too. But we were invited, my community was invited over to the Church Divinity School of the Pacific, the Episcopalian Seminary, to have a social. These were Episcopalians. So they served sherry. Sherry glasses with toothpicks and fruit. Sherry. I'm not a sherry drinker. And I had no intention of drinking. In fact, I had told several of my friends I'm not drinking because of an incident where I was drinking with one of my classmates and a former student, and the kid didn't drink anything, and my classmate had a drink. I finished the bottle, and I became full of ideas. Got the apartment south side of campus, and I blacked out. And I come through about 4 hours later in my apartment in the north side of campus, and I wake up, I pass out. I mean, I'm in the bag. And I woke up the next morning knowing that I had lost control of the evening. So I called my friend, and I said, "What happened last night?" And by the way, that's not the first time I have asked someone what happened last night. And a lot of times what they would say is, "Last night you were a jerk." But see, that's not really enough information. My friend was worried about me, and his dad was a Teamster. And one of his dad's friends was the guy in charge of all the alcoholic Teamsters. Can you imagine such a job? And he asked his father's friend, "What do I do about Tom?" And they gave a couple of pointers, one of which is take notes. Just don't say you were a jerk. Give specifics. Date and time. First this, then that, then this, then that. Document the bad behavior. So I called Jerry and I said, "What happened last night?" And he said, this is an Al-Anon trick question, "What's the last thing you remember?" And I said, "Well, leaving Charlie's apartment." He said, "Oh, well, let's start with the police." And there was a list of half a dozen things. Evidently, I got very angry, and I was screaming about the boss, who likes them anyway, and I had a brick, and I was going to put it through a plate glass window on Telegraph Avenue. I was drunk and disorderly is what I was. And the cops were just going to take me in. And my friend, who had not really been to Al-Anon, said, "I'll get him home, officers." So we got out of the campus, and I got inspired to take off all my clothes. We were streaking around this time, if you want to Google this event. And I was very concerned about General Franco's Spain and Richard Nixon's White House. And I had a lot to say about it. And I started running all over campus, kind of frantic and naked. And my friend would just picked up and he got me, and then passed out. So what's the last thing you remember? When I heard that, he wasn't yelling, he was just reading from a list. I became terrified. The second step talks about being restored to sanity. I really felt I was losing it. My behavior was increasingly erratic and unpredictable. And like after that incident with in Berkeley, the decision I made was not to drink with friends anymore. I'll drink by myself because I don't want witnesses. I don't want witnesses. They get in the way, you know. Anyway, so a few more things happened, and publicly I was not drinking. And that party at the Episcopalian school, I wasn't drinking. I had no intention of drinking. And the guy comes by, this nice Episcopalian seminarian, with a tray full of sherry glasses, not my drink. And my friend said to me, "You can't have that." I had no intention of having that until he told me I couldn't have that. And then I reached out and I slammed one back and took another, and I don't remember much else. I do know I had to get out of there and, to quote Dr. Bob, get a bottle of bourbon and finish the job. So part of my story is the sneakiness and keeping secrets and don't let people know, shame, embarrassment. In my community, I'm lucky. A lot of the people I live with are remarkably good human beings. And the leadership got an education on alcoholism. Late 1960s, early 1970s. You have to redo it like every 5 years, but this is a disease, not a moral issue. People die of this disease. If someone surfaces as having this disease, get them some help. Don't watch them die. So we had a new boss, and he had taught with me at Loyola High School in Los Angeles, so he had seen me at my finest. And I was in trouble. I just turned 29, and I was summoned to the presence of the king. And, you know, I felt shame and embarrassment, and you're called on the carpet. And he said, "We think you should go to treatment. There are places around. Your friends have checked out a couple, but let's get you to treatment." And I said, "What about Alcoholics Anonymous?" And he said, "Try that too. But you're going into treatment." So I went to a Berkeley program that was very AA friendly. They brought meetings in, and we went out to meetings and just giving a shout out to the two women who were in the H&I group that came to Alta Bates Hospital on Thursday afternoons. One was a woman named Burl, and she had an extraordinarily detailed wig, and she was very petite and weighed about 90 pounds and smoked, and I liked her a lot. And the other was a woman named Mary, who had a crooked wig, and big lady, almost 6 feet tall, and she would say, "I'm so glad to be sober. I'm so glad to be at a meeting. I'm so glad to be sober. I'm so glad to be at a meeting." And I thought she was a little slow. Not one of the bright ones, you know? She died about 2 years later because a lot of internal damage and livers and kidneys start shutting down. Burl, I stayed friends with for a long time. And although she looked petite and weighing 90 pounds, when she told her story, it raised the hair on the back of my neck. She was a terror, with a tiny little heroin problem plus. So, God bless her. But they were H&I. And I thought they came because they didn't have any friends. So they came to make new friends. These are lonely old ladies. I want to thank the people that do any hospitals and institutions work, because it makes it. This is 50 years ago. I remember them vividly. And I went to a meeting. Old-timers meeting Friday night at Central Office in Oakland. And they sat around the tables, and I sat at the table. I brought a book with me. I always bring a book, because they leave you alone if you're reading. That's usually true. And the guy chairing the meeting was really happy. He had a little tiny Tom Dewey mustache. You young people can Google Tom Dewey. My father was the chairman of the Santa Clara Valley Dewey for President Committee in 1948. We knew Mr. Dewey at my house. And anyway, this guy, his name was Tom, and he was just happy and so glad to be there. And he said, "You all know my story. I'm not going to bore you with it." They laughed. I didn't get the joke. What's funny? And then someone else shared, and someone else shared, and it was my turn. And I'm quick. I'm Tom. I'm an alcoholic. First time I said that out loud in a room with other people. I've said it alone in my room in the mirror staring at myself. But first time with a group. And "Hi, Tom," which is very aggressive. If you've been isolating for a couple of months, all of a sudden these happy, friendly people are attacking you. This is a Friday meeting, and I said to these folks, my last drink was Tuesday night. So I noticed the folks tonight with 20 days, a couple, 20, I'm really glad you're here. I told this group of really elderly people with whom I had nothing in common that my last drink was Tuesday night. I did not tell him it was in a pizza parlor. I did not tell him it was 2 gallons of beer, or 2 pitchers of beer, I guess. Nothing bad happened. Everything was fine, but it was my last taste of alcohol. When I told them that I hadn't had a drink since Tuesday night, they burst into applause. And we're not a clappy bunch. We don't clap wildly like Southern California does. We need a reason. And someone not having a drink for 3 days is a very good reason to just applaud your heads off. I was astonished at their response. And what occurred to me, because I hadn't been talking about real stuff with anybody for a long time. What occurred to me was I have finally met a group of people who knew what it meant to not have a drink since Tuesday night, that it is a great big deal. Then this other guy shared, younger than me, enormous man. He was Vietnam Special Forces, spent a lot of time in prison because alcohol and rage and wrong parts of town, you end up in prison. He came out of his last blackout. He almost beat a guy to death. And the SWAT team was there, and an awful lot of first responders. And Gary was put into prison, and they put him in solitary confinement because he had such strong people skills. And one of the guards started shoving AA literature under the door. And Gary gets sober in prison, and his first parole hearing, they said, "Don't sit down. Do you have any questions?" "No. See you in 3 years." That was the first hearing. But he stayed sober, and when I met him, he was about 10 days out of prison. And here's what I heard him say at my first meeting. To me, "We here in Alcoholics Anonymous go to lots of meetings." I didn't know that. I don't know what you people did. "We don't drink in between meetings." Wow. "And we don't use no dope." Well, I was astonished. But that became my program for the next 18 months. I mean, there's steps and sponsors and get a book. But I mean, I went to a lot of meetings and I didn't drink and I didn't use. I never did pills very much, for which I'm very grateful. I have some friends who are being killed by pills. They're so cute and small and they'll just kill you. The therapist I saw, Dr. Arthur Solomon, I saw him about why do I drink like I drink. That was reason number one. My second reason going to see him was so I could get a Valium prescription. Because a lot of my friends were on Valium and they seemed much calmer. So I thought I could use that. I'm pretty upset by everything. So I asked him after seeing him for a couple of weeks, could I get a Valium prescription from you? And he said, no. And I didn't know they could do that. I said, why not? He said, because you'd abuse it. I said, exactly. I mean, I'd like to abuse it for 10 years. You know, this is my goal. But I have had Valium. I think I've stolen it once or twice, but I'm not sneaky like that. But people have given me Valium because I look so needy. Maybe half a dozen times. And one of the reasons I did not fall in love with Valium is it takes 20 minutes. And who has that kind of time? What I love about alcohol is it's the instant cure. It teach you all day, you know, school, hot, bad smelling kids, impossible teachers, foolish administration. I get back to the house having fought for civilization all day. And I'd get a water glass and some ice and fill that with bourbon and gulp that in three gulps. And I was able to breathe. So do it again. And I down and thank God. And then number three, I can sip. But I'm finally alive. I heard this at a meeting not long ago. The dangerous thing about alcohol is it almost worked. It almost worked. So I had been smoking marijuana a lot, and the couple times I saw therapists, it was about depression. And I was taking depressants on a daily basis into my body, and if you take depressants on a daily basis into your body, you'll get depressed. I've had this conversation with some people, a friend of mine who's on antidepressants and drinking. And I said, you know, he might not be an alcoholic, but he's very depressed, so why is he drinking? I mean, it seems so obvious to me that it's a bad idea, but evidently not to others. So I went to a lot of meetings. I didn't drink in between meetings. I didn't use no dope. And I finished my studies that year, and I passed, not brilliantly. I had never written anything sober before. I six pack of beer, typewriter, let's go, and create this thing, you know. But without alcohol, I was very off balance and crippled. I really felt that. And I knew I was going to be going back to the classroom, and I didn't think I had anything to say. I had lost most of my vocabulary, and I had been antisocial, and I had been wounded in lots of ways, mostly by my own powers. And so going back into the classroom, back to Loyola High School, second year of sobriety, I learned something, and it was very unpleasant. I learned that I was afraid of my students, and I never knew that because I was loaded. But there are all these kids, you know, and all they have to do is figure out there's 23 of them and one of me, and it's over. And I don't think I was a very... On my side, it was really a struggle to be there and to prepare class. I had no confidence whatsoever. I had to ask other teachers to walk me to the classroom door because the fear was up so much. I was afraid. I didn't know I had fear. I was pretty sure I had anger. And for me, they fit together very nicely. But if you scare me, I get mad really fast. So I'll notice the anger, not the fear. And sober, I was very aware of the fear. I saw a therapist, again, another one, and he suggested that when I walk through the schoolyard, walk slowly, don't run, look at kids instead of hiding my face and running, say hello. And I started doing that, and some of the fear lifted. I stayed in the classroom for 4 years. I don't think I was... It was really hard work. I had to finally leave. And I went into social work for a couple of years. What a good idea. What could go wrong? In West Oakland. I had a sponsor. I had one up in Berkeley when I was newly sober. His name was James, Vietnam vet, little younger than me. And he didn't scare me. So, will you be my sponsor? And we go to meetings together. And we had one deep theological, philosophical conversation. He just said, do you think Catholics are the only people who have the connection to God? I said, of course not. He said, okay. And then never discussed it again. I mean, why? But I needed sponsors. So I wrote the Archbishop, I'm coming into town. I'm sober. I'll be sober a year. If there's another sober priest, I'd sure like to meet him. And I got a nice letter back, and he said, when you get to town, call Father Terry R. And Terry became my sponsor, and he was my sponsor for 43 years. And he was 9 years older than me in earth time, and 5 years more sober than I. Very different personalities, but he is someone I really grew to love and spend time with. And not just listening to him, but watching how he lived the program. We went to the International AA Convention in New Orleans in 1980. I wasn't going to go. Why? But he said, oh, let's go. We shared a room. And he makes his bed instantly. As soon as he makes his bed. And then on his knees, he asks God for another day of sobriety. And at the end of the day, on his knees, he thanked God for another day of sobriety. For him, being sober was such an extraordinary event. He wanted to keep it very, very fresh. We walked down the French Quarter in July. There's some very bad smells on the French Quarter in July, by the way. There's a lot of vomit and pee and who knows what else. But we were at the convention, and Lois Wilson was there, and Marty Mann was still alive, and she waved at us, and we waved back. My first international convention. It was a wonderful experience. I didn't have a lot of trouble with step one. My trouble was always step two. And I want to talk about it a little bit, and then a little bit maybe on step three. In the 12 and 12, it writes about step two. Bill writes about step two, and it's all about faith, belief, faith, belief, faith, belief, faith. I've never liked the chapter. I think it sounds condescending and patronizing. We who believe feel sorry for you who don't. And one day maybe you can believe and be like us. That's what I get from chapter two. Another problem with it is I did believe. I mean, I could do this in Latin, English, and Greek at one time, and I was still drunk. What I didn't have was hope. Because I'm better than you and I'm worse than you at the same time. And the program will work for you because you are simple people. I'm complicated and damaged beyond repair. And it's just not going to work for someone like me. There's a story in the book. I like the stories, by the way. I know that's controversial. Stop reading at 164. Oh, no, keep going. Keep going. You'll be surprised what you learn. This is the chapter. Page 449. Now, in the third edition, it was the only page some people knew, and they shifted it. But this is page 449, fourth edition. When I was released from the asylum, don't you like him right away? I moved to a large city to make a new beginning. My life had become a series of new beginnings. In time, I picked up the drink, got good jobs, and lost them as I had in the past. All the fear and remorse and terrible depression returned tenfold. It still did not register that the drinking might be the cause of all this misery. I'm having trouble with this and trouble with that and trouble with this and trouble. Oh, and I drink a little. I sold my blood. I prostituted myself. I drank more. I became homeless and slept in the bus and train terminals. I scrounged cigarette butts off the sidewalks and drank from a common wine bottle with other drunks. I drank my way to the men's municipal shelter and made it my home. I panhandled. By this time, I lived only to drink. I did not bathe or change clothes. I stank. I became thin and ill. I had begun to hear voices and accepted them as death omens. I was frightened, arrogant, enraged, and resentful of man, God, and the universe. There was nothing else to live for. I was too frightened to die. That's a very good first step. It was at this point that a woman who was a social worker on Skid Row and a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous sat me down in her office and told me her story. How she drank, what happened, how she got sober. No one had ever done this before. I had been preached to, analyzed, cursed, and counseled. But no one had ever said, I identify with what's going on with you, what happened to me, and this is what I did about it. She got me to my first AA meeting that same evening. I had been preached to. Oh, let me tell you. I was at a meeting in the Oakland Tuesday night meeting that I still go to. And we had a young guy come talk with us. And he usually you share your story for 10, 15 minutes, and then it's a discussion. Nothing fancy. He stood up and said, I'm not going to tell you my story. I'm going to tell you what the big book says. That's what he said. I was instantly thirsty. It's the wrong tone of voice to use with this sensitive alcoholic. I wanted a beer. I wanted to crack the beer. I wanted to drain the beer, staring him in the face. Whew. Preach to. Preach to, what's the other one? Analyze. Oh, yeah. I gave a series of talks for some people who were in the medical profession, giving them some pointers on how to talk about spiritual stuff without being overtly religious. It can be done. And they did evaluations. And most said that I had something helpful to say, thank you. But one of the evaluations, number one was so awful I can't remember it. Number two was type A personality. And type three was severely mother conflicted. And I wanted to say, this is not severely mother conflicted. I've done work, you know. Analyzed. Cursed. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And counsel. Can I give you some advice? That special tone of voice. I don't think I have ever followed someone's advice once in my entire life, and I'm an old man. The people at the meetings gathered around me in kindness in those early days, and I did not drink. Fascinating next line. The spiritual demons of withdrawal descended on me. This is when we start waking up to notice how out of whack everything is. The spiritual demons. I'm no longer sedated. I'm no longer with my best friend, my boon companion. I was black, these people were white. What did they know about suffering? What could they tell me? I was black and bright, and the world had consistently rejected me for it. I hated this world, its people, and its punishing God. Yet I believed the people in AA were sincere, and whatever they believed in was working for them. I just did not believe that AA would work for me as a black drunk. I'm unique, I'm special, and I'm different. I genuinely believed that I was different until much later, when I had what I now know to be my first spiritual awakening, that I was an alcoholic and I didn't have to drink. I also learned that alcoholism as an equal opportunity illness does not discriminate, is not restricted to race, creed, or geography. At last, I was released from the bondage of my uniqueness. And that happened for me, but it was a slow, slow thing. The uniqueness was just with me for a long time. I moved to Los Angeles, as I mentioned, and here's the rule. Wherever you get sober is where they do it right. And if you go anywhere else, even across town, they do it differently. And it can be a crisis. They're organized differently. I don't like this. I don't like that. Birthdays. We bear, in my part of town, birthdays, good for you. And then we go on with the meeting. We don't have these processions and peacock feathers and drums that they have in some of the groups down here. Good heavens. I was at a meeting in deepest L.A., and the birthdays were acknowledged the way Academy Awards are given. You know, so-and-so, I want to thank all the little people that made this possible. And, oh, God, it was just awful. I was ordained in 1978. I took it as a third step, as a turning it over, and I try to keep showing up on a daily basis. I still see myself as a kind of broken down old high school teacher. I do lots of other things. I live in a community up in Oakland, and I have some responsibilities there, and it's a good life, and I go to meetings. And I go to meetings because I find them very, very helpful. I was talking to my therapist when I was newly sober, and I asked him, because I felt very damaged. I felt perhaps brain damage, surely social damages, if he thought I was normal. And he said, normal is 98.6. So it's a temperature. And I said, what am I trying to ask you? He said, you're trying to ask if you're okay. How do you know? And he said, well, healthy people, sane people can do three kinds of things. Healthy people can work. Healthy people can love. And healthy people can play. If you can work, love, and play, you've got a pretty rich life. We needed to talk about all of those things because I had trouble with all of them. But working, showing up on time, doing what you've agreed to, cleaning up after yourself, paying your bills, that's a huge thing. And loving the whole world of relationships. Terry would talk about we come in as isolated persons, and with grace and luck and discipline, we find friends, companions, and allies. We find friends and companions and allies, and that's very true for me. I'm very grateful for that. And then learning how to play, learning how to enjoy being alive. Leonard asked me, I was now 6 months sober. He said, so what are you doing for fun? I go to meetings, I said. Good, he says, what do you do for fun? We laugh at meetings. Ha, ha, ha. We have a good time at meetings. And he said, Tom, it might not be enough. You really have to learn how to enjoy being alive. Do you like music? I think so. Why don't you find out? Do you like movies? Maybe. Why don't you find out? Do you like cooking or yard work or the 10,000 things that we can do? So back to Los Angeles, Chicago was playing at the Hollywood Bowl. And six of us sober guys went to it at the Hollywood Bowl. We were the only six not smoking marijuana in the entire Hollywood Bowl. But we did it, terrified, scared out of our minds that we would relapse or begin. It was my first venture into the world of culture and music, and I can do that sometimes. And I like it a lot. I like the doctor's opinion, where Dr. Silkworth taught Bill that this is an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And I'm allergic and I'm obsessed. I can still get obsessed. I don't know whether you've had drinking dreams. I get them every so often. But what does it mean? Is it a prophecy? I dreamt I was drunk again. Does that mean I'm going to be drunk again? If I'm having drinking dreams, should I write the big book out in longhand? Will that prevent that, you know? Or then write it in backwards? I just am so terrified. And having a drinking dream, feeling shame about it. You know, oh my goodness, this is awful. So I waited a while, and then I finally asked Terry, what does it mean if someone in another state is having a drinking dream? You don't want to give your sponsor too much information. You know, you have to soften the blow. And then he said, have you had the one yet? And then he shared one that was so disgusting and perverted, I was shocked. And I had that one 6 months later. So what do they mean? He said, well, three things. Number one, drinking dreams remind us of the way we used to be. Number two, drinking dreams remind us that our drinking was a nightmare. Number three, people who have drinking dreams don't get drunk. He said, did you ever have a drinking dream when you were drinking? Only sober people get them. But I know, 10 years sober, I had a dream so vivid, I woke up knowing I'd lost 10 years. Went downstairs, I just shame, and I cupped a coffee, went back to my room. No broken glass, no vomit. I didn't go out last night. Whew. A more recent one, in the last year or two, I'm flying somewhere. The plane's completely full. I'm in the middle seat. And on the floor at by my right foot is a glass of white wine. In the dream, I remember it, if it was Chablis or Chardonnay or something, but it was a white wine, not my drink. I make sure no one's looking around. I reach down, I pick it up, I take a mouthful, I put it back down. Do that a couple times. And I wake up, kind of jolted awake, feeling sneaky. And I had forgotten how sneaky I had to be when I was active. You know, no one can know the whole story. You're going to hear a piece and you're going to hear a piece, and I hope you never hear anything. And I hope none of you guys ever talk again. But I don't have to do that in recovery. I can, if I have some awful experience, I can immediately call someone and talk about it, which I did on that dream of shame. I called right away and talked to a couple people. Sometimes I'll wake up with a belly full of self-loathing or shame. And what I do is get out of bed and get to the shower, start the day, and then mention it to a couple of people in the course of the day. When that happens, I don't think I need electroshock therapy. I just need to get out of bed. Start your day. I've heard someone say that alcoholism is a lot like dancing with a gorilla. you're not done dancing until the gorilla is done dancing. And when they told the story, they didn't say dancing with the gorilla. They said dating the gorilla. And they didn't say dating. But you are on the receiving end. And you're not done till the gorilla's done. By the way, in South Africa, I tell that story, and I was in Port Elizabeth, and no one laughed. And someone afterwards said, "We don't know baboons here." Oh, no, we don't know gorillas here. If you had said baboon, they would have known exactly what you, because you have to know your audience anyway. If you're clean and sober tonight, it means the gorilla has let go. If the gorilla has let go, get out of the cage. And don't go back into the cage even when the gorilla starts humming your song, which it does. You know? The moon is full, you're a little lonely, you walk by the gorilla cage, and tonight the gorilla is really cute. What could go wrong? I have a friend in Vegas named Wally, and he says, "I don't want to dance with the gorilla, but every so often I want to pet it just a little bit." Stay out of the cage. Now, people who love us visit the zoo a lot. And they look at the lions and the tigers and the bears. And then they look at the gorilla cage and they see the person they love with the gorilla and they go nuts. Something must be done. Someone must do something. Might be your spouse. Might be your mom or dad. That's different. Might be a sibling, brother, sister. Might be one of your kids or grandkids. And just as an observation, if it's one of your kids or grandkids, you really do enter a world of terror that very few other people could understand. So the people married to alcoholics, talk to people married alcoholics. If it's one of your kids, you got to talk to someone as your kid. I gave a talk in Al-Anon up in Hayward, Oakland area, and did the thing, because I'm bilingual, I can talk Al-Anon. And at the end, this lady came up to me, and she had a little girl with her, little girl like 6, 7, 8 years old. I'm not good on kids' ages. But with the, you know, I've been to school, grandmother, granddaughter. I figured that out right away. And I said, "Hi." She said, "I have to talk to you." And I said, "What about?" She said, "My daughter's out there." I said, "You don't want to talk to me. I don't have a daughter." Then I paused, my using my teacher's voice. "Anyone here have a daughter who's out there?" And 6 hands went up. And I said, "Get their phone numbers. They know what's going on. I've seen the movie, but that's not the same thing." We must do something. So we get into the cage and we start vacuuming and sweeping and hanging nice pictures of the Dalai Lama, perhaps some Chinese poetry. Nice vegan meal, surely that will help. And that never helped. Nothing helps. So you get between the gorilla and the person you love, and you try to pull them apart, and the gorilla turns on you and yanks your arms and legs off. Untreated Al-Anonism kills. We die of exhaustion, of grief, of rage, surrounded by alcoholics, dead at 56. So there's a program called Al-Anon. And a lot of the Al-Anon program, I mean, it's sophisticated and complicated, but a lot of the Al-Anon program comes down to stay out of the cage. Let's all repeat that. Stay out of the cage. But I only want to help. We're going to meet over by the giraffes and talk about our obsession with other people's. My friend Annie, her son was in San Francisco apartment, and he's now sober 10 years, but there was a time it was very scary. And she went over to visit, and he and his girlfriend, and the kitchen was just full of crap, dishes and pizza and stuff and things and vermin. I mean, ah! And Annie wants to fix it. But first she called her sponsor, and she said, I want to clean the kitchen. And the sponsor simply said, not your dishes, not your kitchen, not your problem. There's a difference in the programs. The sense of humor is different in the programs. Al-Anons laugh at really dark stuff. Like at an AA meeting, if you were to go and say, well, I was thinking of shooting people and I got stuff, and they were to go, oh, we're very concerned, here's my number, give me a call. In Al-Anon, if you talk about thinking of shooting someone, they just nod their heads. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We can always do it tomorrow. Seems to be the solution. I have defects of character, and that step 6 and 7, I did a 4 and I did a 5, and I wrote about resentments, and I had a bunch of them, and fears, that was a new thing for me, but I had a lot of fear. Sexual stuff, there was some chaos there, and money stuff, there was some chaos there. And I shared all this with my sponsor when I was 2 years clean and sober. And then there's the defects of character, and what do you do now? And we ask God for help. We ask God to remove the defects of character that stand in the way of our usefulness. I took some time off when I was about 10 or 20 years sober, and I went to a Benedictine monastery in New Mexico, and I read the book. And I can find this one here. And this is the short story called He Sold Himself Short, which is one of the first people from Chicago to get sober. And there's some terrible alcoholics in Chicago. I was at a meeting there, and noontime meeting near the Water Tower District, and they read, this is a closed meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anything you say here can and will be used against you in a court of law. Because somebody thought he'd speculate about maybe being involved in a murder, I'm not quite sure. Well, he was. And his defense was, but I said it at an AA. No, that's what you talk to your sponsor about then. Yeah. Some things are not for group discussion. Like, do you think I should be on medication? That's not a group discussion thing. Talk to a real doctor who's been to school. Not just some loudmouth with an opinion. The day before I was due to go back to Chicago, it was Dr. Bob's afternoon off, page 263. He had me to the office as we spent 3 or 4 hours formally going through the 6-step program as it was at that time. The 6 steps were complete deflation, dependence and guidance from a higher power, moral inventory, confession, restitution, 6 continued work with other alcoholics. So it's 1939. Dr. Bob led me through all these steps. At the moral inventory, he brought up several of my bad personality traits or character defects, such as selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill temper, sarcasm, and resentments. I wish there were 12. They stop short of that. But selfishness, conceit, jealousy, carelessness, intolerance, ill-temper, sarcasm. These jumped off the page to me because these really are mine. I'm careless. Prejudices and intolerance and groups of people I was afraid of as a kid, and I didn't like them because they didn't look like me. I had an awful lot of that in my early years. So I got back to California, I called Terry, and I said, I've asked to have my defects of character removed. Why do I still have them? And he said, we asked to have them removed, not erased. They're removed. They're in the attic or the back room of the basement. And they stay there until there's upset, chaos, hungry, angry, lonely, tired, surprise. And they group up in groups of two and three and ambush anyone in the room. And then you have to promptly admit when you're wrong and clean up the mess. I think my first 10 years sober, I was wrong four or five times. And now I find it's much more common and I need to clean the mess up right away. I still don't like authority figures. I have to go out of my way to be nice, to be fair to them, because I'm immediately defensive. There are other groups I'm like that too. I have to watch myself. I want to act rather than react to all sorts of things. I'm an older person. I'm in my 80th year, and I find stairs can frighten me. Going too fast frightens me. New technology scares me to death because I just figured out how to do it and it's upgraded and now it's something else and I don't know what to do. All those things frighten me, and I can talk about it and notice it and I don't pretend it's not there. This scares me. This scares me to death. And life is good. And I get a daily reprieve from the worst of my crazy. But it's all there. Do I still think of drinking sometimes? Do I think of running away from home sometimes? Do I think of shooting people sometimes? Somewhere in my 40s or 50s, I made the decision I want to live a simple life without drama or trauma. And that's how I want to do it. Coming to be some time with you folks is part of that. It's a great experience just to hang out with sober people, people who want to be here on a Saturday night when you could be, you know, under the pier with a bunch of sailors. You know, I know this is, these are choices we make, right? So I think that's everything I know. One last thing, and this is 2 minutes worth of, talking with Terry. Terry got dementia, and so for about 10 years he disappeared. He finally died in 2022, rather. And for 8 of the 10 years, he was still very much there. And then he evaporated. And he got a brain scan. He saw there was darkness. And he talked about it at meetings. He said, I'm Terry, I'm an alcoholic, and I'm losing my mind. Ha, ha, he said, I've got a picture. He'd show them. And he wasn't afraid, he wasn't angry, he wasn't ashamed. It was just part of the deal. It was the next thing to deal with. And I would talk with him. If there were four or five people talking, he couldn't follow. One-on-one, he was right with me. If there were four or five ideas he couldn't follow, one idea, he was right with me. And I talked to him about letting go of some stuff because I'm too busy and it's one of my ways of avoiding certain people, places, and things. I stay busy. And I said, I'm letting go of this, I'm letting go of that. And he said, some things we let go of, some things are taken away. As an older person, I'm paying attention to that. He spoke at a meeting, and he was just fine. He was great on the old stuff, you know. And he said, recovery is not a matter of trying harder, it's resisting less. And I wrote that down too. I like the Serenity Prayer. It's about making decisions. I want to be serene when I make some decisions. I want to be calm. I make bad decisions when I'm overstimulated or excited or angry or scared. I make bad decisions, so give me some serenity. There's stuff I can't change. And I have much less energy and much less time than I used to have. So I don't want to waste my energy or time on things I cannot change. And here are three things I cannot change. I cannot change the past. And I cannot change the truth. And I cannot change you. Loving someone doesn't change them, it changes me. Hating someone doesn't change them, it changes me. As far as the truth goes, let's just start with the laws of physics. What goes up comes down. It's the law. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. It's the law. I need to know these things. gravity, the speed of light. Gravity is deadly if you're not aware of it. You just fall. one of my sponsees was cleaning her roof. She was 74 and fell off the roof. And I said, "What were you doing on the roof?" And she said, "Being a fool." I said, "Exactly right. There are young people that God made to do that for you, and you pay them. You don't climb ladders over 60 years old. It's a bad idea." What can I change? Three things. I can change my thinking, I can change my behavior, and I can change my attitude. And that's the work of the program. And it takes time. It's sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. I was at a meeting in the Midwest. I was about 5 years sober. And the guy talked about how the first year of recovery is about physical stuff. And the second year of recovery is about emotional stuff. And the third year of recovery is about spiritual stuff. And I said, "Boy, that's brilliant." Now I think he had 4 years. And the first 20 years are physical. And the second set of 20 are pretty emotional. And the third set of 20 is all about the spirit. So I'm glad to be here. Enjoy the day. Okay, bye.